This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Not most of the time. Half and half. I guess so. Because they pushed it. The sisters in the back will have to be able to see the board. We need to push this partition. We need to push this partition because the sisters in the back must see the board. Are the sisters in the back able to see the board? This has to be pushed back. This sister needs to see the board. That sister needs to see the board. Yes, we're not gonna sacrifice just for sort of. Sister, are you able to see the whiteboard? Half of it?
You want to push some more back?
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, salatu salam ala rasulullah ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala thumma amma ba'd, to proceed. So welcome back, I guess, and welcome aboard for those who are here for the first time. Inshallah, we will resume our classes, and like we had done in the past, we will go for 1 hour on fiqh, and then we will take a break for like 15 minutes, and we will do al-adab al-mufrad for 1 hour, and then we will do questions and answers afterwards, inshallah. As you may be aware, we will go over al-qa'ad al-fiqhiyya, legal maxims, which is another way of teaching fiqh, particularly that we will use plenty of applications, tatbiqat, amthila. When I was studying this subject, I had always wanted books that provided more examples, because subjects like al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya and usul al-fiqh that are a little bit more abstract would be better understood if you provide plenty of examples. No matter how much you try to explain it theoretically, if you don't have applications, if you don't have plentiful applications, the subject would continue to be vague and ambiguous to some extent. So what we will try to do here, inshallah, is we will try to provide plenty of examples and applications. The title for this, I wanted to say, you know, the beauty of Sharia, but maybe the coherence of Sharia is more suitable for the subject, because, you know, al-qa'ad al-fiqhiyya is about, it's about the coherence of Sharia. And it is about the governing principles that the fuqaha keep in mind when they are making deductions of rulings from the evidences, or when they are practicing fatwa. So we will call it the coherence of Sharia, and the subtitle is legal maxims and their applications in the Hanbali school, and others, I should say, because it will be to some extent comparative, but the applications will be mainly from the Hanbali school, and I was going to talk about this a little bit later, but maybe I should just start by addressing this issue. Why in the Hanbali school? Because it is important for the student of knowledge to be trained in one school. You know, the idea of madhabism, there is like a moderate position on madhabism that is not basically, you know, that many people subscribe to, that does not go to one of the two extremes. So there is always a way for a synthesis between the thesis and the antithesis. Between, you know, strict madhabism and anti-madhabism, there is always a synthesis. But the student of knowledge should be trained in one madhab. There is still the possibility of takhayyur and tanakkul based on their level of education. Takhayyur would be selection, tanakkul would be transfer when they seek a fatwa from a scholar from a different madhab. There is also the possibility of choosing a fatwa from outside of the four madhab with certain conditions. With certain conditions. So the transfer between the madhab is a little bit more flexible, but when it comes to selecting a fatwa or following a fatwa from outside of the four madhab, certain conditions need to be applied. So for the majority of people, for the masses, for the public, I believe in the position, and this is a controversial issue, do you have to follow a madhab or you don't have to follow a madhab? I believe that the public, people don't have to follow a madhab. In fact, they should not be following a madhab because it would be an uneducated decision based in zealotry, nothing else. like if you're not a student of knowledge who can make an informed decision, why are you following this madhab versus that madhab, for the public, for, you know, most of the people who have not studied the madhahib and have not studied the usul of the madhahib and cannot make an informed decision, they don't need to subscribe to a madhab, and many scholars say that they shouldn't. The layperson does not have a madhab. Madhabuhu madhabu mufti. The madhab of the ammi is the madhab of their mufti. But for students of knowledge, particularly those who are on track to become scholars, particularly jurists or fuqaha, certainly the advice of the very vast, very, very vast majority of the scholars through the ages was to follow a particular madhab until you get it down, and then you can study other madhab. Many scholars have transferred from one madhab to another. You know, Tahawi, for instance, is one of them that we know, that you know, a popular figure. Many of them straddled two madhahib, like Ibn Daqiq al-Aid, who was Maliki and Shafi'i at the same time. Abdul Qadir al-Jilani was Hanbali predominantly, but Shafi'i also used to make fatwa, you know, based on the two madhahib. So that there is that possibility, and then many scholars have had encompassing knowledge of the four madhahib, and they had their own selections or their own basically choices. People like Ibn Abdul Barr, Ibn Rushd, Ibn Taymiyyah, they had encompassing knowledge of the four madhahib. However, when we, you know, just for a start, people should, if they want to be on this track of scholarship, they should study according to one madhab. Now, it is very possible that some of the audience here and some of the audience online are not Hanbalis. So how will they benefit from this class? I think that they'll benefit from this class if they intend to basically attend, inshallah, they would benefit, because al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya are mostly matters of agreement between the four madhahib. The legal maxims are mostly agreed upon in the four madhahib. So the qa'idah itself will be agreed upon. The applications that I will mention from the furu' of the Hanbali madhab or the detailed rulings of the Hanbali madhab are not agreed upon. So how can you be an active learner if you belong to a different madhab? Take the qa'idah, go home. That's why I make the document available in a Word format. In the folder that I shared with you. The document is available in Word format. I told you, this is not for sharing, it's for you, but I made it available in Word format so that you could be an active participant, an active learner. You take the qaida and you look for applications in your own madhab. You try to find applications for this qaida in your own madhab. How beneficial would that be? Extremely beneficial. This exercise is extremely beneficial, because when you are an active learner, you get to learn a lot more than being a passive learner, just a recipient, just like a listener. So inshallah, you should be able, if you're not Hanbali. And if you are Hanbali and you want to be an active learner as well, you could expand on the applications that we provide here. You could expand on the applications that we provide here. Because each one of these legal maxims, they're called legal maxims because they have multitudes of applications. So this is how you can be an active learner. So in the muqaddimah or introduction, and I told you that this, inshallah, will be this book will be published, inshallah. So in the introduction, I certainly started by Alhamdu wa Salah ala Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And then I started by a conversation that happened between Imam Ahmad and his son Abdullah. So his son Abdullah was not as a faqih as Imam Ahmad, you know, but he was certainly a great muhaddith. But Abdullah asked Imam Ahmad about horses. And Imam Ahmad said to him, based on the hadith of Asma, where she said that they slaughtered the horse during the time of the Prophet ﷺ and ate it, that they are halal to eat. So Abdullah did not want to ask about the permissibility of eating horse meat. Abdullah wanted to ask if their urine is najis or not. If their urine is najis or not. So what did Imam Ahmad say to him? He said to him, قُلْتُ لَكَ الْأَبْوَالْ كُلُّهَا نَجِسَ إِلَّا بَوْلَ مَا يُؤْكَلُ لَحْمُ. I said to you before, all urine is impure except for the urine of that whose meat is permissible to eat. That which, or that whose meat is permissible to eat. So what is it Imam Ahmad trying to basically underscore here? You have to understand the qawaid. You have to understand the kulliyat. These are the universals through which you could deduce many particulars and many detailed rulings. And if you don't pay attention to al-qawa'id, you will not be able to grasp the basically discipline of fiqh. You're not going to be able to advance in fiqh without grasping the qawa'id. Certainly, he was teaching his son, and his son was a great scholar, you know, a great muhaddith, a great scholar. He's the one who finished the Musnad and put it together and all of that. And I'm just saying that he was not known to be among the foremost fuqaha of his time. I addressed the issue of al-Madhab al-Hanbali, and al-Madhab al-Hanbali is known for following the athar, the traditions. It's a very textualist madhab. It's a very scripturalist madhab. Imam Ahmad responded to 60,000 questions by haddathana. You know, so whenever they asked him a question about anything, he would be able to answer by saying haddathana, so and so informed us from another, from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, or from one of the companions. So his answers to almost to most of the questions that were posed to him were by haddathana. So it is a very scripturalist madhab, a very textualist madhab. And does that mean that basically the idea of taqeed, the idea of having a coherent legal methodology should be ignored, or was ever ignored in the madhab, or the imams of the madhab were not for a consistent legal methodology? Absolutely not. They were completely for a consistent legal methodology. And I say here, to be fair to the other madhahib, just as in the Hanafi madhab that leans towards legal methodology more than textualism, that does not mean that in the Hanafi madhab traditions, you know, prophetic traditions, athar, reports from the Prophet ﷺ and Sahaba were ignored. Neither was this ignored in the Hanbali and the Hanafi madhab, nor was legal methodology ignored in the Hanbali madhab. So in the Hanafi madhab, athar are not ignored. In the Hanbali madhab, legal methodology is not ignored, even if these madhahib were better known for their legal methodology or their scripturalism. You can separate between the two. You need legal methodology and you need scriptural knowledge or the reports from the Prophet ﷺ and the companions. Now, so I talk here about, you know, some people who had authored on legal maxims in the Hanbali madhab, such as, you could certainly find literature on al-Qa'ad al-Fiqhiyya by great imams in the madhab like Ibn Taymiyyah, Tufi, Ibn Qadi al-Jabal, Ibn Rajab, Ibn al-Laham, al-Mardawi, Ibn al-Najjar, Yusuf ibn Abdul Hadi, and among contemporary scholars, al-Sa'di and Ibn Uthaymeen. May Allah bestow mercy on those who passed away. There are also, and everybody I mentioned had passed away, so may Allah bestow mercy on all of them. But there is also a number of scholars who, contemporary scholars who are still alive, who contributed also to Al-Qa'ad al-Fiqhiyya. Despite that, I have not found a book on Al-Qa'ad al-Fiqhiyya. I wouldn't basically want to write a book unless, if I had found the book, I would have certainly not written a book, because it would have been much easier to just translate an existing book. But I have not found a book on Al-Qa'ad al-Fiqhiyya that is organized in the customary, in one of the customary manners, I should say, because there are different manners of organizing books on Al-Qa'ad al-Fiqhiyya. So the most common one, the one that is followed by Suyuti and Ibn Nujaymin al-Ashbah wal-Nadha'ir, is to start by the Al-Qa'ad al-Fiqhiyya al-Kulliyya al-Kubra, Qawa'id al-Fiqhiyya al-Kulliyya al-Kubra. These are the major legal maxims. These are the most comprehensive legal maxims. Some basically mention four and five. Most of the people now will consider them to be five, and I will write the five here now, just to better conceptualization of what we will be talking about. So the first qaida is al-umur bimaqasidiha. And some people prefer to say al-a'mal bin-niyyat for the blessing of the exact wording that comes from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So al-a'mal bin-niyyat. So al-umur bimaqasidha, it means matters. All matters are judged according to their intents. The same translation would go here. The second one would be al-yaqin la yazul bil-shak. So al-yaqin is certainty and shak is doubt, is not basically overruled by doubt, is not negated, overruled, displaced by doubt. So al-yaqin la yazul bil-shak. The third one would be la darar wa la dirar. I should say that the qa'ida is ad-darar yuzal. Most of the people would say their phrasing for this qa'ida is ad-darar yuzal. But this is the exact wording of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam for the blessing of his wording. We will just use la darar wa la dirar. There should be no harm or reciprocation of harm. And certainly, darar is harm, dirar is reciprocation of harm. But when we come to the qa'ida, we will talk about all the different interpretations of the hadith and what dirar means in this case. Al-mashaqqa tajlib al-taysir. Al-mashaqqa tajlib al-taysir would be number four. This is number four here. Al-mashaqqa is what? Hardship, difficulty, hardship. Tajlib brings about or begets or calls for. Taysir is what? Ease, or to make easy. And then Actually, Taysir would be more easing, you know, because yusr is ease, and Taysir is when you make things easy. So there, it is basically upon the faqih when he recognizes the presence of difficulty or hardship to look for ease, to look for making things easier for the mukallaf, for the accountable person, recipient of the fatwa. And then the last one would be al-'ada muhakkama. And al-'ada is what? Customs, habits, customs, that is al-'ada. And we will talk about al-'ada versus al-'urf when we come to this. And then muhakkama, basically, so muhakkam means what? When you're given the power to rule, you are muhakkam. This is the basically passive voice for muhakkim. So hukm is ruling, and the hakim is the ruler. The muhakkam is the one who's given the power to rule. So here they translate this as customs are given consideration. Customs are given consideration. But it may be even more powerful in Arabic when you say muhakkama, more powerful than just given consideration. Customs are given consideration, because muhakkam means is given the power to rule or to overrule. And these are the five. Each one of these five legal maxims has furu'. It has like sub-maxims under each one of them. So these would be called al-qawa'id al-kulliyya al-fiqhiyya or al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya al-kulliyya ghayr al-kubra, that are not as comprehensive. Kubra means major, you know, but when we the other qawa'id, other than the five, are qawa'id that are branches of the five or independent qawa'id. The branches and the independent qawa'id are called the ghayr al-kubra. Some people would call them as-sughra, but they are not really sughra, so people hesitate to call them as-sughra because each one of those qawa'id has tons of applications, so you don't want to basically be unjust to them and call them sughra. So many people would call them ghayr al-kubra. You know, they are just not al-kubra. But there is still kubra. There is still very. All of these are universal. You know, this is sort of universal principles. Anyway, they have chosen these five principles in particular because they have countless applications in fiqh. Just try to memorize the five principles. They do have countless applications in fiqh. And under each one of them, there are so many qawa'id that are branches of these five legal maxims. These legal maxims are agreed upon by all the madhahib. Like I said, most of the legal maxims, and when we come to discussing some of the legal maxims that are controversial between the madhahib, we will point this out. But the vast majority of legal maxims are agreed upon in the four mazahib, even if they disagree on the application. And I'll give you an example. It's a very common example, very popular example, how they can disagree on the application. Al-yaqeen la yazul bil-shak, for instance, which means that certainty is not displaced or overruled by doubt. Certainty is not displaced or overruled by doubt. If you wake up in the morning and you make wudu, you pray, you know, fajr on time, and then go to work, and by zuhr time, you wonder if you use the bathroom. And if you're as old as me, that could happen, you know. You wonder if you had used the bathroom between then and now. And then you just can't remember. Did I use the bathroom or did I use the bathroom yesterday or today? Was that yesterday or today? Anyway, you know, old people can relate. Do you have wudu or you don't? You do, because what you remember is I made wudu in the morning and I prayed Fajr in the morning, so I have wudu. You know, I'm certain I had wudu at one point, and now I am not sure whether I broke that wudu or not. Okay? So three out of the four mazahib agreed with this sort of thought process or line of thinking. One madhab disagreed. The Malikis disagreed. They said that salah is obligatory on you by certainty, and it will not, you know, it would not be fulfilled with doubt. That obligation would not be fulfilled if you have doubt about your wudu. So what is certain here is salat is obligatory on you, and you must perform salah with wudu. That is what is certain. And now, since you have doubt about your wudu, then you must repeat the wudu. You must make wudu. You know, eventually we will have to basically be making choices, and we will have to say, you know, this madhab was more correct than that madhab. This is not to undermine any of the madhab or to be disrespectful to any of the madhab, because one madhab could be correct at, you know, in one application and incorrect in another application, and vice versa. We should be basically more sort of thoughtful about this and more accepting of things of that nature. It should not be offensive at all to say, well, the Malikis got it right here, or the Hanbalis got it right here, or the Hanafis got it right here. That should not be a problem. It's not disrespectful to the other madhahib to say their position is somewhat weaker here. So anyway, but we will come to this discussion in detail, inshallah, when we come to the applications of the Qa'ida. But at least if you want my thoughts about this, I believe that the Jumhur, the majority, were more correct about the application of this Qa'ida. You had wudu for certain, you're not sure whether you broke it or not, then you do have wudu. You do have wudu. So when you pray, you have wudu, because what was certain at one point has not been overruled by the subsequent doubt about your wudu. Anyway, so so they would start by the Al-Qa'ad Al-Fiqhiyya Al-Kulliyya Al-Kubra and the branch of these Qawa'id, and then they would go on to addressing the other Qawa'id that are agreed upon that are not considered as comprehensive as these. And there is no book in the Hanbali Madhab that follows this manner of organization. Some of them would arrange them alphabetically, like al-mawsu'at, like the encyclopedias. They would arrange them alphabetically. But this tariqah, or this manner of organization in Ashbah al-Nadha'ir, is the most common one, the easiest one. It is the sort of the most straightforward one, and it arranges the qawa'id in groups, and it is easier for the student of knowledge to grasp the qawa'id this way. So I followed in my organization of the book, I followed this particular manner of organization, as in Al-Ashbah al-Nadha'ir. So then what I did also is that I included many, many applications, like I said, mostly from the Hanbali Madhab because of reasons I had already explained. And someone may ask, okay, someone may ask, and this is a legitimate question because I asked myself, this is an advanced course. Why are you teaching an advanced course on legal maxims in English? What is the benefit of teaching advanced courses on very specialized sciences in English. And people have, one time a friend of mine embarked on translating Fath al-Bari, and people ridiculed him. They said, like, what? You translate Fath al-Bari? For what purpose? Like, why? Like, someone who will read Fath al-Bari, they had probably already learned Arabic, and they should be able to read Fath al-Bari in Arabic. And that, you know, whatever you think about this rationale, however, there are many benefits for transferring these sciences into English and teaching them in English. So I mentioned some of them, and you may have read my introduction. But I said that نقل العلوم الإسلامية إلى هذه اللغات يبين لعموم المسلمين وغيرهم ما في الشريعة من جمال وحكمة واتساع. Firstly, translating Islamic sciences into these languages showcases the beauty, wisdom, and harmony within the Sharia to both Muslims and non-Muslims. Muhammad Asad, rahimahullah, in his book, Road to Mecca, said about the Sharia, I saw before me a perfect structure with all its elements designed in harmony to complement and support each other, without any excess or deficiency, a balance and harmony that gives one the feeling that everything in the Islamic perspective and its premises is in its correct place, is in its correct place. I have found no subject to showcase this particular concept, the beauty, the coherence of the Sharia, more than legal maxims. That is why I chose legal maxims. And then I spoke about the urgency of doing this, the urgency that we basically elevate the discourse and translate these sciences into English and elevate the discourse in English, the discourse on the Sharia, on Islam in general, in English. There is some urgency here. There is an urgent need, I said, to convey this wisdom and beauty to the general public, especially in light of the numerous attacks on Sharia from its enemies, the ignorance of many of its followers, the superficial and even misguided nature of many of its defenders' postulates, and the proliferation of erroneous or repulsive rhetoric on social media, to the point that some have come to believe that Islamic discourse has nothing better or deeper to offer than what they encounter. And this will be very problematic for many people who will aspire for sort of a deeper discourse than what they encounter. Like, the Islamic discourse is really profound. It is extremely deep, and it is, people are doing it injustice. Their superficial take and presentation of the Islamic discourse. Thirdly, I said, and this is also important, and this is very important because, like I said, using people as a means is mean. You don't use people as means, but so I'm not basically teaching legal maxims because I want to teach legal maxims, and I had this sort of unease. Am I teaching legal maxims because I want to teach legal maxims, or because I see a benefit in teaching legal maxims, a benefit for the audience, not for me? I believe that there is a huge benefit for the audience. Legal maxim, the beauty and coherence of Sharia. And you may say, well, we're Muslim, we're already aware of the beauty and coherence of Sharia. Iman yazid wa yanqus. Faith can increase, you know, and when you're more exposed to more beauty, your faith increases, because likely your faith is not like the faith of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu. So there is some room for increase. And In addition to this, in addition to recognizing the beauty of Sharia, studying legal maxims has great benefits in enhancing a Muslim's and a student's understanding and practice of their religion. It also broadens their horizons and develops their skills in comprehension, analysis, and decision making. Comprehension, analysis, and decision making, which brings significant benefits to all aspects of their life. And lastly, I said that some students proficient in both languages still benefit from studying these sciences in both languages. And that is not only true for students whose main language is a non-Arabic language, or it is even, you know, so you had people who perfected a second language, people like Sheikh Daraz, for instance, Sheikh Hassan al-Shafi'i, for instance, Sheikh Taqi al-Din al-Hilali, for instance. These people perfected another language, whether it's English or French. It did benefit them to perfect another language, even though their native was Arabic, but it did benefit them to perfect another language. It did benefit them to teach the sciences that they had mastered in Arabic, to teach them in English and to be exposed to the literature available in a second language. Then, you know, that was the introduction, and certainly I ended the introduction by the customary ending. And then the first chapter, or the first section, because I divided the book into four sections and many chapters. But the first section of the book will be about the preliminary, it's called the preliminary section on the 10 introductory principles of the science of legal maxims. 10 introductory principles of the science of legal maxims. The second will be on, the second section of this book will be on these and their branches. So the so-called kubra, qawad al-fiqhiyya al-kulliyya al-kubra, the legal maxims that are kubra and their branches. The third will be on the independent that are not kubra, ghayr al-kubra, I will not call them sughra, minor, because they are not minor, but ghayr al-kubra, the not major. qawaid or principles, they are independent qawaid or principles. Like taba, for instance. Like al-ijtihad la yunqad bimithlihi, ijtihad is not overruled by ijtihad. Like tasarruf al-ra'i ala al-ra'i manud bil-maslaha. Basically the sort of, how do you translate this? So al-ra'i is the ruler, and tasarruf would be basically the practice of the Ra'i in their ruling is contingent on maslaha, or contingent on the interest of the ruled. Anyway, we'll find a good translation for it when we come to it. So anyway, these are independent legal maxims that do not fit neatly under one of these five. So this would be the third section, the independent legal maxims that are not branches of these five. And the last section will be on al-dawabit al-fiqhiyya. And al-dawabit, people, like usual, people will disagree over how you translate this. So you could call them regulators or controllers. I felt that calling al-dawabit al-fiqhiyya, al-dabit al-fiqhi, basically is a legal maxim in a sense that regulates the fatwa or the rulings in a very limited scope, in one chapter, within one chapter. I personally feel that kullu qardin jarra nafa'an fa huwa riba is a dabit, it's not a qa'ida. كل قرض جرى نفعا فهو ربا. كل قرض, every debt that brings about benefit for the debtor, for the creditor, I'm sorry, every debt that brings about a benefit for the creditor is riba, I don't need to translate riba. But so this is, why do I consider this a dhabit and not a qa'ida, although this would be controversial? Because it is limited in its scope. Al-yaqeen la yazul bishak, you could apply this to marriage, you could apply this to financial transactions, you could apply this to ibadat, to salah and wudu, like we said. You could apply this everywhere, in all chapters. But kullu qardin jarra naf'an belongs to a particular, you know, it regulates a particular set of rulings, or, you know, that pertain to riba. So these are the four sections. The first one is about the introductory principles, the 10 introductory principles. What are the 10 introductory principles? What do we mean by 10 introductory principles anyway? So when they teach a particular science, they want to familiarize the audience, the student, with the sort of the bird's view of the science, and an outline. They want to introduce the science to the student. And they have, there are 10 principles that you want to follow to introduce a science to a student. What are these? Sheikh Sabbah rahimahullah gathered them in a nazm, or verses of poetry, in which he said, "Inna mabadi'a kulli fannin," and the meter will not be broken if you say ilm instead of fan. "Inna mabadi'a kulli fannin ashara." الحد والموضوع ثم الثمرة وفضله ونسبة. I like ونسبته وفضله Okay. Okay. Remind me. والوضع والوضع. Okay. نسبته وفضله والوضع الاسم الاستمداد حكم الشارع. الاسم الاستمداد حكم الشارع. نسبته وفضله والوضع. الاسم استاذ مسائل والبعض بالبعض اكتفى ومن در الجميع هذا الشرف. اوكي سو ان مبادئ كل علم عشره الحد والموضوع ثم الثمرة نسبته وفضله والواضع الاسم الاستمداد حكم الشارع مسائل والبعض بالبعض اكتفى ومن در الجميع حاز الشرف. So mabadi' here, the principles of every science, علم, عشرات, الحد, definition, الموضوع subject matter, الثمرة the benefit or the fruit. ثمرة means fruit or benefit. نسبته وفضله والواضع نسبته relationship means relationship to other disciplines, relationship. وفضله, its virtue. والواضع, its founder. الاسم, its name. And where did the name come from? Al-istimdad, its sources. Hukm al-shari'a, the ruling of the shari'a. It's Sharia ruling. Is it fard kifaya to learn it? Fard ayn to learn it? Is it mustahab to learn it? Masail, it's topics or issues. Topics. Well, ba'du bil ba'd iktafa, some would suffice with some of these. Uman dar al jami'a has a sharafa. He who encompasses all of them or knows all of them had attained honor. So these are this is what we will be talking about in the first section. We will be talking about the definition. We'll start by the definition because that's what they start with. We'll start by the definition. We'll talk about the subject matter also with the definition, the benefits, the virtue, the relationship to other sciences, basically its relationship to usul al-fiqh and fiqh and other related sciences of Sharia, its name we will talk about the name with the had, and then the sources and Sharia ruling, as well as examples of some of the topics. So the first, basically, thing that they talk about when they address any science Good. Okay, so what do they usually start with? They usually start with the definition. They usually start with the definition, which is al-had. Why do they call this al-had? Al-had. Okay. Sometimes we will branch off just to make sure that to make sure we have like a comprehensive approach to the topic. Sometimes we will branch off a little bit. So forgive me. Al-Had is basically introduced into the different sciences from the science of mantiq, logic. Because Aristotle felt that you can't have conceptualization without a definition. And he felt that there is definition proper, which we translated as al-had. By the way, why was logic translated into mantiq? Nataqa means what? Spoke. Because Arabs put a lot of emphasis on speech. So for us, our mantiq is nah, because it guides the speech. And once you regulate your speech, you regulate your thought as well. So eventually logic was translated as mantiq. But mantak is basically about speaking. Even in the definition of the rational animal, so the definition of insan, according to Aristotle, is what? Rational animal. We translated this as haywan natak. Basically, if you translate this literally, it would be speaking animal. It is actually a rational animal. It was translated as haywan natak, but they recognize that notq here means reason, understanding, rationality. Anyway, but this is part of it. So, quickly, let me tell you, you know, where this belongs and why al-hadd is important, even though I have basically a Taymiyyan take on mantiq, but let me tell you what the Taymiyyan take on mantiq is. Taymiyyan take on mantiq is not basically to dispose of mantiq altogether, but to examine it critically. So when you examine any discipline or science, you don't want to be oppositional, but you still want to be critical. You should not be oppositional, but you should be critical. And I'll just in order for us to know where this belongs to the general discussion, why al-hadd is a big deal, and why it should be a big deal. Let me tell you this. So the science of logic in general, Aristotelian logic, and I'm talking about Aristotelian logic or Montecassori Aristotelian logic, it's all about assumptions that all knowledge belongs to two categories. One category is called tasawwur, conceptualization. And the other one is called tasdiqat, or tasawwurat, conceptualizations. And tasdiqat, assertions, judgments, assertions. And in order for you to have a conceptualization, like when we say insan, you have to have a conceptualization of what that means, what insan means. And then when you say al-insan natiq, this is an assertion. This is basically an assertion that is composed of a subject and a predicate. And then you, this assertion will be accepting of affirmation and negation. Conceptualization is not amenable to affirmation or negation. It's just conceptualization. There is no relationship here, whether it is affirmatory or negatory. There is nothing about affirmation or negation here. You're just talking about a conceptualization. And al-kulliyat, these are the universal categories. The five universal categories are needed for al-hadd, which is definition proper according to Aristotle, and that is the ultimate, basically, the ultimate way for conceptualization. You need a hadd for conceptualization. All knowledge belongs to conceptualizations and assertions, and for conceptualization you need al-hadd, and for al-hadd you need to have an understanding of the five categorical universals. What are the five categorical universals? Al-jins, al-nawa, al-fasl, al-khassa, al-arad. So al-jins basically is the genus, and al-naw' is the species, al-fasl is the differentia, al-khassa is the property, Al-arad is accident. And in order for you to have a definition that is proper definition, these three are called what? Zati or essential. These two are called what? Accidental or aradi. In order for you to have the perfect definition, according to Aristotle, you need al-jins with al-fasl. Al-jins, the genus, and the differentia. Example, because examples make things clear. When you say al-insan haywan natiq, the human is a rational animal. The human is a rational animal. What is animal? Al-jins, the genus. Al-insan belongs to that genus, animal. How did you differentiate the human from the rest of the animals? By saying rational. So al-insan, haywan, natiq, al-insan is a rational animal. So you have the genus and the differentia. How does the differentia, al-insan is the species. How does the differentia differ from the property, which is al-khassa? When you say al-insan, katib. Katib is what? Writer. By potency or by actuality? By potency, this khassa, you know, do you know of any other animal who writes or that writes? No. So it's khassa. It's specific for the insan, khassa, a property that's specific for the insan. And then you have the accident, which is a property that is not specific. When you say an insan, haywanun mashi, an insan is an animal that walks. Are there many other animals that walk as well? Yes. So while this is true for the insan, it does not sort the insan out from other animals. So it's called al-arad, an accident. In order for you to have a definition, a proper definition, you will have to have the jins and the fasl. Why al-fasl and not al-khassa? Because if you say al-insan haywanun katib, does it do the job? Yes. It does. Okay, but he said that this is an essential attribute, and this is not an essential attribute. So natiq rational is an essential attribute, katib is not an essential attribute. But we have a contention against this, because katib is either katib bilquwa or katib bilfa'l. So katib by potency or katib by actuality. Katib by potency should apply to every insan. Every insan is katib bilquwa. So this distinction itself between essential and accidental is basically, it is not only a main contention, but many people recognize that that this distinction does not really hold true. And then, okay, so you got to the definition. Before I move to tasdiqat, and this is a very quick summary, because inshallah our next class will be on mantiq, but this is the sort of the 5-minute summary of the mantiq. But before I move to tasdiqat or assertions, here are like a few Taymiyyan contentions. Maybe like he had tons of them, but a few Taymiyyan contentions against mantiq in general. He said that most of the people, most of civilizations, the Chinese and so on and so forth, they had sort of accomplished civilizations without knowing mantiq. So it's unnecessary. Who agreed with him completely on this? Bertrand Russell. He said, if you want to do yourself a favor, don't waste time learning Aristotelian logic. But anyway, so that was one. The second is, The two assumptions that were made about al-hadd, that it is necessary and sufficient, necessary for conceptualization and sufficient, he basically tore them apart. It's not neither necessary nor sufficient for conceptualization. He said, if you, first of all, he said, when you say an insan haywan natiq, you say that you can't have any conceptualization except through had, definition proper. Okay. You told me an insan haywan natiq. You actually went from the species, which everybody knows, insan, to something that's a little bit more subtle and a little bit more subtle in definition, because there are many types of haywanat and they all look different and so on. So he made it a little bit more difficult by going to the genus. And then you said natiq. I don't have a conceptualization of the hayawan or the natiq based on your proposition, except through a definition. Define both for me. And if you have to define the hayawan, you have to use jins and fasl. And if you have, and then define those for me. And then define those for me, and it leads to the tasalsul. Because every time you give me a definition, it's composed of two parts. I want you to define the two parts, and then each one will be composed of two parts. And then if you say that it goes back to awaliyat, axiomatic knowledge, I will tell you, okay, the insan is, it's quite clear in front of most of the people. But anyway, so this was one contention. He said that had you not seen the insan, it would, this idea that haywan natiq will give you a conceptualization of the insan without seeing an insan is false. It's false. And the other definitions, al-humar haywan nahak, for instance, al-hisan haywan sahib. If I haywan nahak, and the ass brays, or is an animal that brays. If I did not hear the braying of the ass, that definition would have never given me any capacity to conceptualize al-himar, or the donkey, or the sound of the. So, at any rate, he said, if you don't have an empirical experience of these things, the definition will get you nowhere in conceptualization. And the definition is not necessary for conceptualization either. So it's neither sufficient nor necessary. But keep in mind that al-mu'arrifat for us, and also in Aristotelian logic, because he has definition proper, and he has causal definition, and he has what else? So al-mu'arifa, the nominal definition. So ta'rif for us, when you make ta'rif of a particular topic, a particular subject, a particular science, anything, you make a ta'rif by what is called al-had or al-rasm or al-lafz. And under a rasp, there are different ways of making ta'rif. So we will not get into the details of this, but this would be definition proper, and this would be sort of a descriptive definition, and this would be a nominal definition. Aristotle had a causal definition. I don't know if he had something that would correspond to rasm for us exactly. Does he, Jake? No. So I don't think that he has something that corresponds to rasm in particular. So rasm is basically when you have a definition that is not a complete definition. You go to the higher genus, not the nearer genus. You give definition by the genus and the property versus the genus and the differentia. That would be called rasm. But we also use Taqseem and Tamthil for our definitions. Taqseem is when you say, for instance, that al-alfaz fil arabiyya ismun wa fi'lun wa harf. You know, al-kalam fil arab fil lugha al-arabiyya yanqasim ila ism wa fi'l wa harf. So speech in Arabic is either name, verb, or what? Particle. Okay, but I think that there is another word for it. Ism wa fi'l wa harf. These are so. This is a definition according to us because it gives you a conceptualization of what we're talking about. Taqseem. When you say that water is H2O, so two atoms of hydrogen, one atom of oxygen is water. Does this give you an idea about water? It gives you an idea, but it is not necessarily a definition proper. And in fact, most of, you know, nobody follows Aristotelian logic in natural sciences and most of the universities in the world. Nobody basically waits for a proper definition to conceptualize anything. Having said all of that, why am I saying this? Because despite the Taymiyyah contentions against al-hadd being necessary, and sufficient for conceptualization, he did not deny the importance of al-hadd. The importance of al-hadd. He said al-hadd is important. Al-hadd is important not for conceptualization or tasawwur. Al-hadd is important for tamyiz, distinction, to distinguish one thing from another. He was completely for a good hadd, for a good definition, for tamyiz, to distinguish one thing from another, because al-hadd is neither necessary for conceptualization nor sufficient, but it is important for tamyiz. So should we be starting every sort of book or every class by addressing al-hadd or al-ta'rif? Yes, we should, because it is important for al-tamyiz. So when I give you a good hadd or ta'rif of al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya that we mentioned before, you will be able to tell the difference between al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya and al-qawa'id al-usuliyya. You will be able to tell the difference between al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya and al-fiqh. You will be able to tell the difference between al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya and al-nazariyat al-fiqhiyya. You will be able to tell the difference between al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya and al-dawabit al-fiqhiyya, and so on and so forth. So, al-tamyiz, to distinguish this particular science from other sciences, not necessarily full conceptualization. If I give you many applications, you will have a conceptualization of the subject of al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya. And just to finish this particular istitrad, or branching off, التصديقات, according to Aristotle, there is only categorical syllogism that will result in knowledge. So syllogistic reasoning, not analogical, not inductive. And the difference between syllogistic reasoning and analogical and inductive reasoning is what? Syllogistic reasoning, you're coming from a universal, a kulli, to particulars. So the most common example is what? Every man is mortal. Socrates is a man. Socrates is mortal. That's a syllogism. So Taymiyyah contention against this is, okay, I agree with you. It's good. It actually that formula results in if these premises are correct, the conclusion is correct. He agrees. He particularly agrees with what's called the shakl al-awwal, or the first form. Okay, good. How helpful is that? Like, how do you produce knowledge like this? Knowledge is produced by coming from particulars to universals, ascending from particulars to universals, to basically to put down laws and for the universe and so on. You have to come from particulars to universals. When you descend from universals to particulars, how is that beneficial? How is it beneficial anyway? Everybody knows that Socrates is mortal. And he says, you say that inductive reasoning does not result in knowledge. How did you figure out that every man is mortal if it is not through inductive reasoning? Every man is mortal. What do you mean every man is mortal? How do you know that every man is mortal? Every man I saw was mortal. Well, did you see all men? So that is incomplete induction. It's incomplete inductive reasoning. That is istiqra naqis. You have not seen all men to say that every man is mortal. So basically, your assumption or your proposition that we can only reach knowledge through syllogism, not through induction. And the issue here for Imam Abi al-Abbas ibn Taymiyyah rahimahullah was the fact that through induction you could come to certainty in the existence of God. You look at the signs in the universe, you come to certainty in the existence of God. Because if you require syllogism to come to certainty for the existence of God, that will always be a matter of debate and a matter of philosophical contention. And he also wanted to defend analogical reasoning. So when you say, when we say al-kullu muskarin haram, or when we say that khamr is haram because khamr is muskar, and that is the illa, and we say that nabith is muskar, therefore nabiz is haram, that is analogical reasoning. Analogical reasoning is when you give a particular the same ruling as another particular because of sharing the same illa or effective cause, sharing the same illa or reason or effective cause, the same rationale. You say that this does not lead to knowledge. But if you say kullu muskar haram and nabith muskar and nabith haram, you say this leads to knowledge. These are the same premises that are here, and you say one of them because of the form leads to knowledge, one does not lead to knowledge. He says, if you can identify the illa, which would be the middle term in your syllogism, the middle term is the illa. Muskir is the middle term, and it is the illa in your syllogism. If you can accurately identify the illa, you could accurately deduce, so through analogical reasoning, a true proposition through analogical reasoning. Anyway, so he says that most of the knowledge that is produced, most of the beneficial knowledge, has to come through induction and analogy. You know, from particulars to universals. Induction is from particulars to universals. You know, and this is how you, in the first place, got to every man is mortal, through induction. And then analogy, which is from a particular to another particular. But to come down through syllogism from a universal to a particular is futile. Who agreed with him completely a few hundred years later? John Stuart Mill. He said, the most futile thing is syllogistic, categorical syllogism, because you keep on coming down from universals to particulars. How helpful could that be? But he did not deny that a good syllogism results in knowledge. He did not deny that a good syllogism results in knowledge. That is why we will study logic, inshallah. That is why it is helpful to study logic and to come to it not from sort of an emotionally oppositional attitude because you don't like Aristotle. No. You know, Aristotle was a genius. Of course he was. Studying this knowledge will have some benefits, but you come to it with a critical mind, not an oppositional, emotional mind, but with a critical mindset. So next time, inshallah, when we come back, we will start with al-had for al-qa'ad al-fiqhiyah, or for the definition for القواعد الفقهية. أقول قولي هذا وأستغفر الله لكم. سبحانك اللهم.